Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
No wave off for Israel from the Bush administration. No ceasefire in Gaza.
It's got to be a sustainable, durable proposition, and Hamas has to stop rocketing Israel. And I don't think you're going to have a viable ceasefire until they're prepared to do that. It's got to be sustainable and durable. It can't just be a resumption of what was there that was violated on the 19th of December by Hamas.
Is the Bush administration's response to the Gaza crisis a durable U.S. endorsement of the bombing and invasion, or a signal that things may change in Obama land? Facts on the ground in Gaza and Washington, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 5th, 2009. There's an echo
you
in here.
You keep saying that.
I like saying 2009.
Yes,
today, the latest on the Israeli ground offensive in Gaza, the Obama inauguration, and business schools. Well, they're changing to fit the times.
They better.
Right. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Israel is pounding Gaza by land, air, and sea. The ground assault is set to enter a tougher phase of intense house-to-house fighting. Mohammed Abu Shaban lives in Gaza City, where he says the streets are empty.
If anybody goes to the streets, you will see that it's somehow being a city of ghosts or something related.
Israel promises the assault will continue until it ends Hamas rocket attacks into Israel. We'll talk to a correspondent on the way into Gaza in just a moment. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris just wants a chance. He can be a contender. Somebody.
My whole thing is to just give me the opportunity to do what the law has allowed me to do, and we will take it from there, and I will work with everybody in the Senate to make sure that the agendas are carried out for the people of America.
Will he get the chance? Democratic Senate leaders say they have no problem with Roland Burris. It's the appointer, Governor Rod Blagojevich, who has Democrats blocking Burris's path. Burris says he may sue if he's not sworn in this week.
Also in the Senate, the Minnesota race takes a baby step forward today. The state canvassing board will declare the results. Democrat Al Franken holds a 225-vote lead over Republican incumbent Norm Coleman. Declaring results sounds final, but there's actually no winner yet. The candidates have a week to challenge the results. Governor Bill Richardson has withdrawn his name to become Obama's Commerce Secretary, and that is because he is under investigation for dealings with a campaign donor. He denies any wrongdoing. He'll stay on as governor of New Mexico.
The House is going to grill the Securities and Exchange Commission on the $50 billion Madoff scandal. The fight for the Super Bowl is down to eight teams. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Arizona, and San Diego all advanced in weekend NFL playoff action. Go to our website. We got the whole breakdown of who meets whom next weekend. Friday, the Dow was up nearly 3%. So was the S&P. The S&P begins trading at 9:31. So if you're a business school, how do you design a curriculum for these times? What we need is an axiom, some lesson that business school students should be taught on day one. And we want it from you. 877-8 my take, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And six words or less. No, I'm just kidding. It can be as many words as you want. But honesty is the best policy. You think
that's
that
good.
Would be a
good
one?
That was
one?
Good. Yep. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. But then what would you do in finance, I guess?
You should only lend to people who can pay you back.
There's a thought. There's a thought. People with money. That's right. 877-8 my take. Wisdom for business school students in 2009. My take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin in Gaza, where there's a long list. A ground offensive by Israel. Fewer rockets from Hamas into Israel, according to some of the few witnesses inside Gaza who've seen it. More diplomacy, little reaction from the Obama transition team, and seeming support for Israel from the Bush administration. Those were among the developments this weekend and this morning in the conflict between Hamas and Israel. French President Nicolas Sarkozy is set to meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders later today. Ethan Bronner is the Jerusalem bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, and we caught up with him earlier this morning as he was fixing a flat tire on an arduous journey into Gaza from Jerusalem. How long has it taken for journalists like yourself to get to Gaza, Ethan?
There's been a lot of pressure on the Israeli government and military to let foreign journalists in, which they have not done for the last 2 months, mostly, and certainly not at all during the 9 days of the conflict.
So based on your reporting and what you were able to see over the weekend, it appears there is a network of checkpoints within the Gaza territory that divides it up roughly north-south and vaguely east-west. Can you explain?
This is simply a kind of divide-and-conquer system. There, in terms of the north-south roads and the east-west roads, the roads that the Israelis had also been involved in building when there were settlements in there, this is a way, of course, of cutting sections off from each other and in that way trying to control them.
Now, is there any sense that the opening of the roads and the creation of these checkpoints is going to facilitate aid getting into Gaza, or is that a completely different question?
That is a good question, and I don't know the answer. It seems to me that the aid is coming in through the checkpoints that the Israelis have outside of Gaza, and then the question would be getting them to the hospitals and to the warehouses and so on. And it may be that the checkpoints will help. I'm unaware of whether that's the case.
Right, and we'll just have to see. So psychologically, what is the significance of having Israeli boots on the ground in Gaza once again in the middle of this crisis?
Well, of course, there are two psychologies we're discussing. One is the Israeli and the other is the Palestinians in Gaza. I would say that from the Palestinian in Gaza, the psychology, at least the desire for it, what Israel wants to send as a message is to say, we will go to all lengths to stop the rocket fire and to break the military infrastructure of Hamas. Within Israel, the argument is that we, again, the similar sort of thing. We are going to stand up for what we believe in and go all the way to put our young men in harm's way. So that's clearly the message that's being sent. The issue is whether there will be actual combat for days on end or whether the hope is to send this message and then work out a diplomatic ceasefire in the coming days. And I don't know.
From the perspective of people you speak with in Israel, Ethan, on the one hand, definitely going in and dealing with the rocket fire directly is, something that I'm sure there's a lot of enthusiasm for. But as time goes on, there's probably a disheartening sense that here we go again with a more or less open-ended commitment inside a territory that we don't like being in. Can you define what the parameters of quagmire are at this moment in Israel?
It's a great question, and I think that, again, we're back to psychology. The issue is, for Israelis, a sense that their enemies had taken the view in recent years that they had lost the appetite for this kind of combat. And even though, and in particular because of what happened in 2006 in southern Lebanon, viewed essentially as an Israeli defeat, the worry in a way has doubled, which is that organizations like Hamas will take the view that Israel doesn't have the stomach for such a battle. So Israelis, I would say 80% of the country, feels very strongly in favor of this endeavor. Now, when will they start to lose the stomach for it? Clearly, if casualties are high and as it drags on. But we're talking about now the second day of ground combat, so I think it's very early to talk about that level of fatigue. There are voices, mostly on the left, saying, okay, we've made our point, now let's work vigorously for a diplomatic solution. The suffering in Gaza is too great. The risk to our soldiers is too great. We need a diplomatic solution. But the broad sentiment in the country is, let's take this a little further.
Ethan Bronner, final question. Any sense that this is timed to precede the inauguration of Barack Obama?
I I don't think that we could point to anything specific to that, but I think that it is very, very likely that the Israelis saw that once the administration shifts in the United States, it's likely to have less patience and less latitude for such an endeavor. The Bush administration has been extremely understanding, if you like, from Israel's perspective about what it's doing, and it's unlikely that the Obama administration would be quite so much. So I do think there is a sense that this needs to end by the inauguration.
Well, a last chance, and the Israelis seem to be taking it in the waning hours of the Bush administration. Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, thanks for joining us on the road to Gaza.
Thank you, John.
Back here in the U.S., Capitol Hill is gearing up for the 111th Congress, which gets sworn in today and convenes tomorrow. But in the Senate, it's unclear exactly who is in, not to mention who will be on board for President-elect Obama's upcoming stimulus plan. For a preview, Todd Zwillick, reporter from Capitol News Connection, joins us now from Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
A lot of things to get to, but let's start with just the actual formation of the Senate itself. There is all of that controversy over the appointment of Roland Burris. Is he going to be seated in the Senate?
No one knows. No one knows. No one knows if or when. Word is he plans to be here in Washington late this afternoon or tonight. He has said he will show up on Tuesday and try to get seated. That doesn't mean he necessarily will. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, who is the assistant majority leader, the majority whip, has said that he and Reid will meet with Burris on Wednesday, which is a day after the 111th convenes. They actually convene tomorrow. So the answer, Adora, is that nobody really knows what's going to happen or how confrontational this will be.
So drama on that front. We'll have to wait, especially for congressional watchers. Let's move, though, to you have a couple of Senate seats, Senator Clinton, Senator Salazar, and Senator Biden, who they're all getting sworn in today. But of course, we're expecting them to take positions in the Obama administration. And so someone else is going to fill their seat, right?
Right. Well, you have a total in the 111th Congress on Tuesday, you have a total of 13. Well, not Tuesday. See, this is where it gets confusing. There should be a total of 13 new senators taking office this year. But then you have to subtract, right, Joe Biden's replacement. He's going to be vice president. Hillary Clinton, she'll be secretary of state. Salazar will be interior. Clinton and Biden, we know, will be senators on Tuesday because Clinton has said that she will remain in office technically until she's approved, until she's confirmed as Secretary of State. That doesn't mean she'll participate as a senator. She probably won't because that won't really be appropriate from the standpoint of a separation of powers. But she will be a senator. Biden just won re-election in Delaware as a senator at the same time as winning election as vice president. So he will have to be newly sworn in sometime between now and the 20th, one assumes he'll resign as senator. So a total, most likely, of 13 new senators. How many new senators are actually sitting in their seats on Tuesday remains to be seen. Of course, you also have Burris. You also have the replacement for Clinton. Probably won't be there on Tuesday, but no one knows who that's going to be. And don't forget about Minnesota with Al Franken and Norm Coleman, the incumbent. That race isn't quite settled yet.
Right. So there's lots of questions about who's actually going to be in the Senate as they move forward on big issues like the stimulus package. There have been some leaks about what the Obama team is thinking of. But there's also it's clear that there's some resistance in the Senate to passing anything quickly.
Well, the Senate Democrats, especially, and to an extent the House Democrats, had hoped to do something very quickly and have it on the president's desk, basically waiting for him when he walks in the Oval Office on January 20th for the first time to get that bill signed, waiting for the new president, like his first official act kind of thing. Republicans in the Senate who do have the power to slow things down if they stick together are starting to lay down markers that they don't think that a bill that could be up to $1 trillion in size, maybe not quite that big, but anyway, big, that it should not be something that moves through onto the Senate floor and moves through that through the Congress without close consideration. So what that means is close consideration and hearings, which is what they're talking about, that's code for slow this down, which is exactly what they intend to do. And now you're hearing Democrats saying that they don't think that their dream of getting this on the desk by January 20th is really going to happen either. So it looks like slowdown is the watchword there.
Okay, here we go for 2009. Todd Zwillick, thank you.
It's going to be exciting.
It's going to be exciting. Thanks, Todd. Todd Zwillick, reporter from Capitol News Connection. He joined us from Washington, D.C.
It's going to be super slow-mo, I think. from what he was saying.
Yeah, but who knows? Let's see what happens this week. Every week we make predictions, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're not.
Stimulus package.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. On this first Monday of 2009, if you've dusted yourselves off and are preparing yourself for the new year ahead, and haven't decided to change a career because of the deteriorating economy and are, say, still a business school student, let's talk about, wisdom for these times. If you're going to business school these days, what's an axiom that should describe how you would approach these uncharted waters of the economy? Honesty is the best policy. Don't throw high-interest loans at glass houses. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, or both a borrower and a lender be, repeatedly. Tell us a phrase at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What we need is wisdom for 2009. And here to talk about the wisdom being imparted to business students in this era is Chris McKenna, who's a program director for the MBA program at Said Business School at Oxford University. He's right here in our studio. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
We've talked with some business students as the economy started to teeter and, you know, Bear Stearns evaporated and, you know, all the rest. Is it more important to have a business degree in this environment or a history degree in this environment?
Well, as somebody who teaches in business school, I teach business history in a business school. So, I think it's both, basically. I think you need to understand what's going on at the moment. And I also think you need to have some sort of sense of the world as it's evolved over time.
Well, let's talk about how the world has evolved in the last 18 months. Is it fair to say that the days of getting a math degree and coming up with a sophisticated algorithm for trading derivatives or currency and making, you know, $10 million, is that over?
I'm not certain it's over, but I think it's going to be a lot harder for people to just walk out of a degree and do that the first year. I think that people are going to have to have some sort of sense of what it takes over the long term to kind of embed these profits in an organization.
Isn't it the responsibility of business schools to teach the sort of basic understanding that value in terms of a lender or a borrower comes from the actual face-to-face human-to-human relationship that you have? And the more you get into the numbers, the more it gets kind of squirrely and fuzzy, and you don't really have value until you know that that person isn't lying to you.
Yeah, I think value is generated in the long term by the relationships that people build and the innovations that people build into an organization, and that the sense that simply just counting things is not the way that people are going to build value. On the other hand, I mean, you need to know how to count, and business schools have to teach people about basics about how to value things.
How many years does it take to learn how to count?
My memory is it takes a few years to learn how to count, but they count in ways that I don't necessarily count. But I think that these are set of skills. For one thing, it's a language, and people need to learn a language so they don't feel scared.
Yeah. Language of finance.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so what you need is you want people who have a real sense of an organization, but who also aren't afraid when somebody comes in the room and starts throwing around numbers and starts throwing around terminology, and they feel comfortable with that. So it's a combination of all those things.
How has recruiting changed? Who wants to go to business school now, who maybe didn't want to go 18 months ago and vice versa?
Well, I think a lot of people obviously were doing very, very well and wanted to stay at their jobs for as long as they were doing so well. They didn't feel like they could take off time. Now, with things slowing down, it may not even be that people are out of work. In fact, it isn't generally those kinds of people. It's the people who say, you know, this isn't going to be a very interesting place to be for the next few years. But the other side of this is that—
Wait a minute. Let me stop you there. It sounds like you're saying that people are leaving work, that the economic downtime are a chance to, okay, I'm going to school
exactly.
to ride this out.
Yeah. This is their chance to walk away. They're kind of bored at the moment, right? I mean, things have gotten quiet. They're not seeing a lot of opportunities over the next couple of years. They're thinking, you know, now would be a really good time to do what I've always wanted to do.
Right.
And a business school allows them to do that.
They're bored in that sort of terrified, I might lose my job kind of way. Yeah, okay, just to get it clear. So why do a business school degree? Why? I mean, why do that? Maybe the lesson of these economic times is forget the numbers, forget the fancy stuff. Just come up with a product or a service that people want and then hire somebody to do the counting.
Yeah, but that said, I mean, I know what you're saying, but I think there's still, as I say, there's some value in the terminology and the language and in the kind of things that we talk about. But also remember that there's some breadth to what we do in the business school, that we are interested in politics, in psychology, in history. So you're getting a broad education in how markets work and how markets have evolved over time. The other thing is that what's interesting is the evolution of the kind of people who do business degrees now. It's not just people in business. This is what we're seeing is this is a general degree for people in both who are involved in government politics, but also people who are involved in the nonprofit sector and development work and things like that.
What's going on in Europe? I mean, Oxford is a very interesting sort of perch to look at the Western industrialized economies. You know, you've got across the Atlantic, the United States, and then you've got the very different sort of approach of the central banks in Europe. What's the European approach as far as business school is concerned?
So European business schools are interesting because they're shorter. The degree programs are shorter. They're 1 year in length generally. And also that they're much more embedded in the university. So the business school in Oxford, for example, is very much part of the university and not a separate organization. But the other thing that I think people are interested in Europe is a comparative perspective. So you get international students from all over the world. Only a third of our students are from Europe. Less than 5% of our students are from the UK. So it's a very international perspective you're getting, and a kind of vision of what the world can be.
Is that to say that it's the U.S. got it wrong? We're not repeating those idiots' mistakes. Is that part of the curriculum?
A little bit. But mostly, I think it's that what can we learn from around the world, not just from one place.
Well, Chris McKenna, thanks so much. Chris McKenna is a program director of the MBA program at Said Business School at Oxford University. As far as business school axioms, Smokey emailed us with something that's the unofficial slogan at Google, actually. Don't be evil is a lesson for business school students. Now, headlines for Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Good morning. 27 minutes past the hour. President-elect Barack Obama is back in Washington. He'll meet up with congressional leaders today to discuss his economic stimulus plan. He was hoping Congress would have something ready for him to sign on Inauguration Day. Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer thinks that mid-February is a more realistic deadline.
We certainly want to see this package passed through the House of Representatives no later than the end of this month, get it over to the Senate and have it to the President before we break for the presidential break.
That was Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer on Fox News Sunday. Obama aides said yesterday that the plan could include over $300 billion in tax cuts, and Republicans have asked for more time to examine this plan details. A Hamas strongman in Gaza is urging Palestinians to crush invading Israeli forces. Gaza health officials say that at least 70 civilians have been killed since the Israeli ground offensive began this weekend. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak says that the offensive will continue until Israel achieves peace and tranquility for its residents. The new American embassy in Iraq is now open. The world's largest U.S. embassy building opened in Baghdad today with a price tag of nearly $600 million. It's symbolic of the U.S.'s transition from occupying power to ally. Obesity increases the risk of ovarian cancer by almost 80%. That's the news from a new study by the National Cancer Institute. But it only counts amongst women who've never used hormone therapy for menopause. Now, researchers think that excess body mass can lead to increased production of estrogen, and that may well stimulate the growth of ovarian cells and play a role in developing ovarian cancer. And that's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We have a question for you. Are you heading to Washington, D.C. to President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration? You have exactly 15 days. How are you planning? How are you getting there? Who are you going with? Why would you want to be there?
I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. My name is Ruben, and I will be attending the inauguration. One of the interesting things about it, though, is that we have a hotel room, and we've just found out that everything is sold out, so we are actually planning on selling our hotel rooms for the highest bidder on eBay.
And he's from Baltimore. He's
getting entrepreneurial. Would love to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. That's a good one. He's going to sell his hotel ticket. Anyway, this morning, the Obama family wakes up in Washington, D.C., their new home for the next 4 years. The inauguration is 2 weeks away, as I said, and it's going to be historic in many ways. Nia Henderson, a White House correspondent for Politico.com, she's been making a list of all those historic ways, and she joins us from Washington. Good morning, Nia.
Good morning.
So he's the first African-American to become president of the United States. That is historic. Let's start there.
You know, I'm of the belief that, you know, we keep using this phrase historic, and I'm certainly of the belief that you almost can't over-exaggerate this point enough, and it's certainly going to draw millions and millions of people to the Capitol on January 20th. And, you know, people are taking buses, they're taking trains, they're taking caravans. I know so many people just kind of personally who are like, yeah, I'm, you know, chartering a bus with my church, and I'm driving up, so we're going to have a, you know, kind of jam-packed event on January 20th.
Just talking about the numbers, I didn't realize that President Johnson actually has the record. 1.2 million people mobbed, right, as it's been described, Washington, D.C., to be there for his inauguration. But they're expecting almost three times that in Washington, D.C. for Barack Obama.
Yes, they are. I mean, you kind of hear different figures kind of tossed around and also people kind of backing off them, but also saying they really have no idea. You know, figures have been as high as 5 million people expected here. And part of that, you know, and they say, you know, they can handle that. And part of that is just kind of looking at how many people can fit on the mall. The question still remains, if you can get, you may be able to get 4 million people on the mall, but can you get them, you know, off the mall and on the subway and where they need to be in terms of cars and leaving the event. So, you know, I think there's still, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of uncertainty and probably a little, you know, anxiety about the numbers.
And that would lead to issues of security, I would guess. And so how are they preparing in Washington, D.C. for this throng of people they're expecting?
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, security will be incredibly high. And for those 240,000 people who are, you know, who will be ticketed, they will have to go through security. And there are all sorts of, you know, all sorts of restrictions, no umbrellas, no signs, no bags. And, you know, I mean, the cops are going to, you know, kind of flood the zone. And Secret Service, of course, has handled, you know, an event like this, not of this size, obviously, but they're certainly going to be ready for it.
And I've read, for example, that they're actually going to be doubling the number of law enforcement and that even police officers from New York are going to be heading to D.C. I understand there's roughly 4,000 police officers in D.C. and they expect to at least double that to be anywhere between 8 and 10.
Yep, those are the exact figures that they're thinking about, and certainly, like you said, bringing in folks from other states. So, you know, they've got a real challenge on their hands for this. I think there are 15 million, you know, tourists come to D.C. A year, and this is, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but it's you know, almost half, but, you know, a quarter of that or something. I mean, they've got a real challenge on their hands. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the things they're hoping is that, you know, kind of supply and demand will kind of shrink the numbers. And also Barack Obama and Joe Biden are stopping off in Philadelphia. They're stopping off in Baltimore and in Delaware on the way here on
the train ride, okay. Right. The train ride to Washington, D.C. But one of the fun facts I read is that a ticket, as you noted, they are actual tickets that you need to get into the inauguration, that a ticket is going for online like $20,095.
Yeah, and you know, I would be careful about that. You know, these tickets are they're somewhere in a lockbox somewhere, and $20,000 for a ticket. You know, make sure it's not. You know, you might want to hold that under the light because you know there's certainly counterfeiters out there. So be careful is all I would say in terms of people who are willing to spend that much money. If you've got $20,000 to spend on a ticket, you might want to just donate to the inaugural committee and be sure you're going to get tickets, because if you do that, you get all sorts of tickets to balls, and not to kind of endorse donating to Barack Obama, but that that's certainly one of the legitimate ways to do it, and you can probably be more certain that you're going to get in.
Nia, for this city, it seems like a really important moment. I mean, unlike the Reagan inauguration, where you saw a lot of pageantry, but it really didn't have much to do with the city of Washington. And as you know, Washington is one of the most liberal places in the United States, and with one of the largest African-American workforces in the United States. I mean, this is a real coming together for the city of Washington in a way that we probably haven't seen, possibly even since the Civil War.
D.C. was, one of D.C.'s nicknames is Chocolate City, and so I think you're going to kind of see that kind of obviously reflected in who comes to the inauguration. Lots of people who are here are obviously going to go to the inauguration, and they're drawing, African Americans from all over the country, and it really is going to be one of those, efforts that's both local and state and federal, and really just kind of a cooperative effort for this, and a really kind of coming out party for D.C. and black folks and America. I mean, I think that's what inaugurations are supposed to be, kind of symbolizing kind of the renewing of the American spirit and democracy.
And today, the Obama girls head to school at Sidwell School. So a big day for the Obamas. Nia Henderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. You guys take care.
Nia Henderson is a White House correspondent for Politico.com, and she was reporting to us from Washington. And now Femi Okeh is going to bring us up to date on the headlines.
And the time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Israel is attacking Gaza by land, air and sea. The ground assault is set to enter a tougher phase of intense house-to-house fighting. Hamas promises strong resistance. Israel says it will fight on until it removes the rocket threat against its civilians. There's no cabinet job this time for New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. He's withdrawing as Obama's Commerce Secretary pick, and he's now under investigation for ties to a campaign contributor. The donor got a large state contract. Both Richardson and the contributor deny any pay-to-play happened, and he will stay on as governor. The congressman chairing today's hearing on the Bernie Madoff scandal says that he hopes that it's not, and I'm going to quote him here, a gotcha session. A House panel wants to know how the money manager accused in the $50 billion investment fraud scheme flew under the government's radar despite warnings about his methods. India says that it's handed evidence to Pakistan about the November terrorist attacks in Mumbai. It links them to elements within Pakistan. It includes details from the interrogation of the only surviving gunman and conversations between the attackers and their alleged handlers in Pakistan. Medical supplies, food and blankets are on the way to those hit by a whole series of earthquakes in eastern Indonesia. One 10-year-old has died and more than 100 buildings badly damaged in the tremors yesterday. And that's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. We're hoping that you remember Ryan Bowen. He's a recent Occidental College graduate, and he's been biking for weeks now. More than 4,000 miles he is trying to attain from L.A. to President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration, and he's still on his way. Good morning, Ryan. Where are you?
Good morning. I am currently in Madison, Florida.
Okay. Madison, Florida?
Yeah, it's about 60 miles east of Tallahassee.
Last time we spoke to you, you were in Texas, and since then, New Year, Christmas Eve, you've had a few things happen. Let's start with the mishap. What happened between you and the Jeep?
Well, it was between myself, one other rider named Josh, who's been following me since Austin, and an LSU student in the Jeep. We were riding into Baton Rouge, and it was about In the evening, about 8 p.m., and he didn't see us, and we saw him, but we couldn't stop in time, so we ended up plowing into the front and bouncing off of his vehicle. But, you know, we went and got checked out and got the bikes fixed up, and no worse for the wear.
But you do have a bump on your leg.
Yeah, it's been going down. I got a contusion on my left thigh, and so I had to see a physical therapist, get some massage work, but they encouraged me to get right back on the bike. It's probably the best thing to do.
And so you did get your wish, though, because last time we spoke to you, you were hoping that you'd get a pal to ride along with you. So Joshua's been with you since when?
He's been with me since just before Christmas when I was in Austin, Texas. And so for the last 2.5 weeks, he's been riding. And I'm looking to pick up some more riders. I actually got 2 riders with me now. One joined me in New Orleans. Another's joining me in Florida. So this movement that I've been speaking about is building. As I get closer to D.C., I'm hoping to have even more riders. So
how would you sum up your experience so far?
You know, it's been great. It's almost overwhelming to see the kind of response that I've been getting from both the media and all the individuals that have been following the website at bikingforobama.com. It's been incredible. There's been many individuals that I've met who have really inspired me as well.
And you've found places to stay and food to eat as you've gone. You want to tell us about your experience with the church?
Yeah, you know, when I was in West Texas, I decided to call up some churches because I didn't know anywhere I could stay. I didn't know anybody in within a 1,000-mile radius. So I called up Christ Church in Ozona, Texas, and they told me to come on in this one evening for their fellowship and Bible study. And so I was like, hey, there's food, and I might as well come and meet some folks. And so I came in, and they were so generous to me that not only did they come and feed me, but they ended up taking up a donation and offering and supporting me financially on the trip as well.
And that's the kind of outpouring that you've been talking about. Very quickly, because we don't have that much time, and we certainly will check in with you again, but are you concerned about going up the East Coast now? Because, you know, it's winter here.
You know, I've been a little pampered staying as far south as I have. You know, yesterday I was riding about 75-degree weather and blue skies. So I'm prepared with the rain slicks and the snow gear to make the turn up north in a couple days. But, you know, I've been thinking about it the whole time, and the cold is coming, and I'll be prepared for it. It's going to be about the shortest time of my overall journey, so I'm not too worried.
All right, a determined Ryan Bowen. We wish you luck, and we'll talk to you soon. Ryan Bowen is a writer and cycling activist, and he's biking to Obama's inauguration in D.C. from Los Angeles. Came to us from Madison, Florida.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 5th, and Femi Okeh's got the headlines.
Good morning. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris is going to be in D.C. He says his appointment by disgraced Governor Rob Blagojevich is legal. Now, Burris got a joyous reception at the New Covenant Church prayer service in Chicago last night. So the congregation is looking very happy, very supportive, and Burris also spoke at the church service, leaving no doubt he was going to try and take up his Senate seat.
I couldn't have sent a better person to Washington to represent the 13 million people of the state of Illinois than myself. I've dedicated my life to public service, and you all have caused me to have the opportunity to serve.
Now, Burris was named by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich last week, and the governor is facing federal charges for allegedly attempting to sell a Senate seat. Democrat Al Franken also hopes to take his place as the junior senator for Minnesota. The counting phase is basically over in the race between him and current Senator Norm Coleman, but the state canvassing board is set to announce today that Franken is 225 votes ahead, but there will probably be legal challenges. As a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi. So, back to Gaza and the Middle East. From an Israeli perspective, the crisis in Gaza between Hamas and Israel is actually quite simple.
Hamas needs a real and serious lesson. They're now getting it.
It's Israeli President Shimon Peres speaking yesterday on ABC's This Week. And the U.S. government is apparently willing to allow them teach Hamas a lesson. Here's Vice President Cheney.
I think we'd like to see a ceasefire, but it has to meet those conditions. It's got to be sustainable and durable. It can't just be a resumption of what was there that was violated on the 19th of December by Hamas.
Almost an echoing of what Shimon Peres said there by Vice President Cheney. Not quite, but almost. And here's President Bush in his radio address.
In response to these attacks on their people, the leaders of Israel have launched military operations on Hamas positions in Gaza. As a part of their strategy, Hamas terrorists often hide within the civilian population, which puts innocent Palestinians at risk. Regrettably, Palestinian civilians have been killed in recent days.
Joining us now is Scott Shane, a reporter in the Washington Bureau for the New York Times. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And let me just ask you right off the top, is the language of Bush and Cheney there in the context of the Bush-Cheney war on terror the template for the Barack Obama administration in thinking about possibly mediating this conflict between Israel and Hamas, if indeed that is their intention? Or is it possible that what we're seeing from the Bush administration is a kind of a wink and a nod, go for it, you've got three more weeks, then everything changes?
Well, it's obviously a matter for speculation at this point. Barack Obama has, to the annoyance and disappointment of Palestinians and their supporters, remain silent during this whole 10-day period in which Israel has launched this assault on Hamas. And his aides say that's because we only have one president at a time. There is some feeling that Israel may have timed its attack to get it in before Obama becomes president. They knew they could count on Bush and Cheney to be very strong supporters as they take on Hamas, which the United States officially considers to be a terrorist group. And they weren't so sure about Obama, although what's interesting, of course, is that even though Obama has not spoken out on this, people have turned back to his visit to Israel in July when he visited a city near Gaza that has been a regular target of Hamas rocket attacks. And made a statement that was, implicitly at least, very strongly supportive of Israel's right to respond. He said, if someone was sending rockets into my house where my two daughters sleep at night, I'm going to do everything in my power to stop that. So at least implicitly, he seemed to recognize that Israel had a right to respond. And in fact, the Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak, cited that statement in justifying what Israel's done.
So on the surface, it appears that the uncertainty about the Obama administration compared with the certainty of this kind of support they're getting from the Bush administration is driving this to some extent. But there's also, with Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State, a pretty strong record on the part of Hillary Clinton supporting Israel as the New York senator. It's almost a constituency in New York to basically express vocally and repeatedly your support for Israel in a situation like this.
That's absolutely right, and there are other Obama advisors who have a history of being very, very strongly pro-Israel, strong supporters of Israel. I think one other factor that may have played a role in this is Israel may not have wanted to. They may have felt they were going to take this action sometime soon, and they may not have wanted to have this define their relationship with the new Obama administration. They may have wanted to sort of get this underway or perhaps over with before President Obama is inaugurated.
Yeah, indeed, that would argue they would get it over with before the 20th. I hate to put you on the spot here, Scott, and if I am, just tell me to take a hike. But is there any precedent for this kind of a situation where a policy is initiated in this transition period with the expectation that things might radically change with the new administration in the U.S.-Israel relationship?
I have to say, you are putting me on the spot, and I can't think of any.
Yeah, I couldn't either. I was thinking all morning this morning. I think this is an unprecedented situation, and so the question then is it conceivable that this could be finished by January 20th?
Well, I think the ground invasion has made that much less likely, and certainly increased the chance that there will still be fighting going on when Obama takes office. Even if the fighting has quieted, there's no question that he has another sort of crisis on his already rather crowded agenda that he's going to have to face in the first days of his presidency.
One positive note, and maybe it's actually not positive, but from somebody's perspective, it's probably positive. It's difficult to always pin that down, and when you're talking about the Middle East, but it seems as though the rhetoric of this conflict is suddenly down to Hamas versus the world, not so much a Palestinians versus Israel thing, and that may be the first page that Barack Obama picks up on January 20th, that Israel at the very least has managed to narrow the conflict to Hamas, and, you know, the Palestinian movement broadly is more of a moderate institution player here.
That's probably true. At the same time, one of the interesting aspects of this is that Mr. Obama had, of course, promised a new approach to relations with the world in general, and particularly with the Muslim world, and had given positive speeches about starting what he called America houses in Muslim countries that would offer English lessons and internet service, and there was even going to be, and maybe there will be, an America's Voice Corps that he would send out to talk about American tolerance and American values. And he also has promised to give a major speech in a Muslim capital in the first 100 days of his presidency. This, at the very least, the fighting between Israel and Hamas shows how events can sort of take over a presidency and shape an agenda, and it isn't necessarily up to Obama to choose when and how he reshapes relations with the Muslim world.
Well, a complicated set of opportunities and challenges. Scott Shane, for the discussion of the timing of this vis-a-vis the inauguration of Barack Obama, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Shane, reporter in the Washington Bureau for the New York Times. He joined us from Maryland.
As we start the new year, we were thinking about a new slogan for business schools. That's because lots of students are going to be applying this year to get in, and perhaps they should be taught things like honesty is the best policy, or, I don't know, don't throw high interest loans at glass houses.
If you lend someone $700 billion of someone else's money, you know, without bothering them too much, try to gently get them on board with the idea of keeping some written record of what they do with it, without being a jerk or without being an ogre about it.
Okay, no jerks and no ogres. We're also looking for your help. We want to hear stories about your plans for the inauguration. Are you going to Washington, D.C.? And how much work is it to try to get there?
Hello, this is Margot Adler. I'm a correspondent for National Public Radio. And I'm going to the inauguration in a very unusual way, which is that I am flying to Rochester, New York, very much in the opposite direction of Washington, D.C. I'm getting on a bus with the African-American Barbers and Beauticians for Obama. We are going to ride 12 hours to the inauguration and probably stand in the crowds.
And I guess we'll be able to see Margot because she'll have the fabulous, fabulous perm there in the crowds of the inauguration. It's good to know our colleagues at NPR are sharing their stories. You can, too. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're following Barack Obama's proposed stimulus package, but are there congressional roadblocks?
Close consideration and hearings, which is what they're talking about, that's code for slow this down, which is exactly what they intend to do.
That's our friend Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. We're always on, and if you missed anything, take our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Mr. Franken goes to Washington? Really? How's that going to work?
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
It's not known how many people would like Stuart Smalley as a senator, but a 225-vote margin is reportedly good enough for Al Franken to declare victory in the Minnesota Senate race today. Does Republican Norm Coleman have a lawyer smart enough to stop the Franken juggernaut? Doggone it, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 5th. Indeed, it is a new year, but not a new Senate race in Minnesota. They are still counting votes. Good morning.
And they got 7 days of possible court challenges. So good morning, Adora.
We're going to take a look at that. Also, we'll take a look at the developing Obama stimulus plan, cabinet drama for Obama, and the latest from Gaza. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
The Gaza conflict is set to enter a critical phase. Israeli ground troops have quickly taken less populated areas, but now comes the much tougher fight in dense Gaza City. Hamas promises strong resistance there. Israel says it will fight on until it removes the rocket threat against its civilians. As the battle rages, several international efforts for a ceasefire deal are trying to stop the fighting. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris is headed to Washington. He's also trying to distance himself from Governor Rod Blagojevich.
I'm not in any way backing up or supporting or endorsing the governor's action.
He does apparently endorse the governor's action of appointing Burris to the Senate. He's threatening to sue if he's not sworn in, and Democratic leaders say they're going to block him.
More on that Minnesota Senate race. Today, the state canvassing board will declare results in the race. Democrat Al Franken holds a 225-vote lead over Republican incumbent Norm Coleman. Coleman's team has said he will challenge the results. Here's his lawyer on KARE-TV.
It's my assessment at this time that it's virtually certain that somebody is going to be filing an election contest.
We'll talk to a Minnesota Public Radio shortly about this story. New developments in the $50 billion fraud investigation of Bernie Madoff. The House will grill the SEC today on why its investigators didn't do more. Governor Bill Richardson will not be the next Commerce Secretary. He withdrew his name because he's under investigation for dealings with a campaign donor. He denies no wrongdoing.
The Super Bowl picture is a bit clearer this morning. Eight teams are left in the hunt, advancing are Philadelphia, Baltimore, Arizona, and San Diego. That was in playoff action over the weekend. Wall Street starts its first full week of trading in 2009, a while later this morning, actually about 30 minutes from now. Friday, the Dow was up nearly 3%. So was the S&P. They both close above 9-something. The Dow at 9,034, the S&P at 931. So we're looking for your help. We want to hear stories about people traveling to the inauguration. Are you going? How are you getting there? How's it going for you? Are you coming from a long way away? We've even talked to people who've been on bicycles, traveling the country for weeks now. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And also, business schools have to change their curriculum in this environment. You have any sort of wisdom that business school students should learn in 2009 that maybe wasn't part of the curriculum, you know, even like a month ago? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, the Obamas wake up in Washington, D.C., the city that will be their home, at least for the next 4 years. President-elect Barack Obama has 2 weeks until he officially takes office, but his work has already begun. Peter Baker is a reporter for The New York Times, and today he reports details on the developing Obama stimulus plan, including $300 billion in tax cuts. Peter joins us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Would it be accurate to call them leaks since we haven't seen an official proposal yet?
Well, certainly these numbers are being floated out there in order to, get them out in the public discussion dialogue. We have not yet seen a formal plan. Probably won't see one for a little while. President-elect Obama meets today with leaders on Capitol Hill to try to, make some progress further in terms of formulating this plan. But you're seeing the outlines come together because I think, we're testing the water and we're trying to, in their case, they're trying to address concerns and tamp down opposition that might be developing.
So we're talking about roughly an $800 billion plan that would stretch over 2 years. Do you want to give us some of the details as you've uncovered them?
Well, in terms of the tax part of it, what they're talking about are both workers and businesses that would create jobs here. The worker part of it is what President-elect Obama talked about during the campaign, something called Making Work Pay Credit, which would give up to $500 per worker, $1,000 for families, up to a certain income limit. They're still discussing what that income limit would be, but during the campaign, he talked about $200,000 being the cap. On the business side, they want to give credits to businesses that create jobs and retain jobs. They want to give different depreciation schedules and write-off abilities that would get more money into the hands of companies that are investing in equipment and factories right away.
So essentially, there's a real focus on job creation and tax cuts, and in part, that is because they believe that will help the economy, but also that's what they believe will get through Congress, right?
Yes, of course. Obviously, it's a mix of policy and politics, as these things often are. You're beginning to see, after a period of dormancy by Republicans, some increasing vocalization of their concern about this. This is a big package, $800 billion, $775 billion that they're talking about. Is unlike anything we've seen in quite a long time, even more than the financial bailout from last year. And, on top of all of that, the deficit is going to go through the roof. What President-elect Obama is saying is don't worry about the deficit for the next 2 years. It's too important right now to get the economy jump-started. And as part of that, he's going to talk this week about efforts to get federal spending under control once this emergency crisis, if you will, passes.
But he, as you said, there's certainly some resistance because you have a whole lot of Republicans who are not in the mood to be writing any more big checks following all the bailouts from the end of 2008.
Well, that's right. That's right. But on the other hand, I think that there's obviously a honeymoon period for a new president here, and there's a desire on the part of lawmakers of both parties to do something or at least be seen as doing something given the enormity of the problems of the economy right now. We saw, again, last Friday, more economic numbers about the depth of the problem in terms of manufacturing. So, Republicans at the moment are pushing for more study, for more hearings. Senator McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said yesterday he would rather the part of the package that goes to states mm-hmm. be in the form of loans rather than grants. But this is all posturing. At the end of the day, he also said he thought that a lot of Republicans might support the final package as long as the Obama team was willing to listen to some of their concerns.
Whatever happened to increasing taxes on those who make more than $250,000 a year? I didn't see that in any of the reporting.
Yeah, that's not at the moment on the table. First of all, for this particular package they're talking about, the one that he wants to sign within days or weeks after taking office, President-elect Obama is not including tax increases because he's focusing, as you said, on issues and measures that are perceived to help stimulate job creation. They haven't given up on the idea of rescinding or the getting rid of the Bush tax cuts as they apply to people over $250,000, but rather than repeal them this year in a proactive legislation, they're looking more and more like they're going to simply wait for those tax cuts to expire in 2010, which is the way the original law was written.
Okay, Peter Baker, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Peter Baker is a New York Times reporter who is coming to us from Washington, D.C., and no doubt we'll be speaking to him soon.
Well, if you were calculating what effect the tax cuts might have on your income, or focusing on the Bill Richardson withdrawal from the Commerce Secretary nomination of Barack Obama, you might have missed the appointment of Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia to head the Democratic National Committee when Howard Dean steps down later this month. Kaine, of course, was partly responsible for putting Virginia in the Democrats' column for the first time in 50 years. Joining us now to talk about the significance of this appointment, both in terms of the man and in terms terms of sort of the place that he's located is Anita Kumar, who's a Richmond-based staff writer for The Washington Post. Anita, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. How are you?
So Tim Kaine, of course, is a good friend of Barack Obama's, but the significance of this appointment, it seems to me, is the fact that it's a governorship and that it's in a red state or a formerly red state of Virginia. What does that say for Barack Obama's view of politics moving forward?
Well, that's right. I mean, Governor Kaine's not the first governor to do this job, but he'll be doing it part-time for a year. But obviously, he was looking for someone. Richmond obviously is close by, a couple hours away, a state that's still sort of considered conservative, but obviously has gone Democratic in recent years in a lot of different offices. And, of course, Barack Obama won it this year, so he's definitely looking towards the future. Tim Kaine's going to try to help him out in the 2010 midterm election, so that'll be quite important.
Now, the success of the Obama campaign related to grassroots organization, the use of sophisticated technology, and really maintaining a ground-level political force in all 50 states. Is this something Tim Kaine is good at?
He's been in office 3 years here in Virginia as governor. This is his final year. And his accomplishments, his achievements have primarily been political in Virginia. Now, some of that is just Virginia, the population changing and things going on in the state. But the governor is widely credited with helping Barack Obama win Virginia. Both U.S. Senate seats have now gone to Democrats since he's been the governor. He's helped turn the state Senate to Democratic-controlled. I mean, essentially, the only thing left for him he'll be trying to do this year is the House. State House is still in Republican control. So he's widely credited with helping Virginia turn blue, if you will. And I think that's what they're trying to expand across the country.
Now, Tim Kaine is a young guy, and he's... he doesn't necessarily have the national stature of some others that could have been chosen for this. I'm wondering if there's an argument here that maybe Barack Obama, at least in the early going, and he's going to be a part-timer, Tim Kaine is, while he's still governor in Virginia there in the first year, if this is a deliberate effort to de-emphasize the Democratic National Committee post because Barack Obama doesn't want to be perceived as someone who immediately starts running for his second term as, say, Bill Clinton did.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think if you would talk to people, you know, obviously the DNC and the RNC chair are oftentimes very much figureheads. I mean, yes, they're expected to raise money and be on the Sunday morning talk shows, but a lot of the day-to-day things are done by someone else, and obviously we've already heard that Barack Obama is talking to someone else about taking that day-to-day job. Barack Obama asked Tim Kaine if he was interested in this job, and Tim Kaine had said, actually told reporters here in Richmond, and he told Barack Obama that he was not interested, he would not leave the governor's mansion before his term was up in January 2010. I think this is more, than Barack Obama came back to him and said, no, I really want you to do this. I think this, this gets Barack Obama the guy that he wants and allows him to keep that pledge of staying in office for the next year.
Well, gauge the enthusiasm of Tim Kaine stepping up and being something of the face of the Democratic Party, particularly in terms of state and congressional races. Is he enthusiastic about taking a national role in this way? Is this something he would like to do?
He has, as you said, he wasn't very well known outside of Virginia until probably this election. He has always been an outgoing, energetic guy and was considered an up-and-coming leader in the Democratic Party. In 2006, he gave the State of the Union response, and that was probably the first time a lot of people had heard of him. But, he was considered one of the three vice presidential possible picks.
Sure.
He was on the talk shows all the time, and he was considered that he did a good job in going around in the country and talking for Barack Obama.
And so a profile that's undoubtedly going to be raised with this appointment. Anita Kumar, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Anita Kumar is a Richmond, Virginia-based staff writer for The Washington Post talking about Tim Kaine, governor of Virginia and the new head of the Democratic National Committee.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I don't know about you, but I'd hate to be a business school student in this day and age, so we're looking for an axiom for new students, a phrase of wisdom they should take to heart as they take classes and think about graduating.
Six words or less, huh? For business schools, the merchant should think like a customer.
Tell us your phrase at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Our listeners are always right.
And we're going to talk about Governor Bill Richardson now of New Mexico. He had been picked by Barack Obama to become his next commerce, or his first commerce secretary, I should say. But because of a federal probe Richardson was involved in, or is allegedly involved in, he has pulled out. He has withdrawn his name. Richardson denies any wrongdoing in the face of these allegations. Bill Dupuy is a news director at KSRFR. Santa Fe Public Radio, where The Takeaway is heard every morning. Good morning, Bill, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning, Adora. Good morning, John.
This almost seems like a question of timing. We all know timing is everything, particularly in politics. Tell us about this investigation and what the allegations are against the governor. Let's start there.
Well, the timing issue is very important. You bring up a good point. The investigation has been leaked to the press. It's been in the press for several months now. It involves a financial company in California that allegedly got a $1.5 million bond issue contract from the state after donating money to Bill Richardson's political interests. That's what the grand jury supposedly is investigating. It's secret, of course. Grand jury deliberations are secretive. It's a crime to disclose them. So how the leak came out just ahead of the nomination is indeed the question everyone is asking here.
So give us that timeline. I thought this story had broken sometime over the summer, but you're saying that, no, it broke in the last month?
Well, it broke over the summer, the fact of the grand jury investigation of the company and potential interest with the state. But the name of Bill Richardson didn't come up until a leak about a month ago.
I see. And so is it heating up at this point, or do you think that the governor pulled out, given what's happened in Illinois with this notion of pay-to-play so prominent in the news, that he certainly didn't want to have this given national attention as he went through the appointment process as Commerce Secretary?
Well, of course, we don't know if it's heating up or not because it is behind closed doors with the grand jury. But I suspect the Obama transition team wanted every candidate for a federal job to be squeaky clean. There could be no questions. And certainly if Bill Richardson had gotten to the nominating process and the confirmation process, this would have come up.
What has been the reaction in New Mexico to these allegations against the governor?
Everyone is, of course, stunned, not the least of whom is the lieutenant governor who is planning to be the governor, the first woman governor of New Mexico. Diane Dinesh was poised and has her own transition team in place. Bill Richardson was to have given his opening address at the beginning of the state legislature on January 20th, and then he was thought to be out of office after that. But now that appears to be not happening.
And so the investigation is moving forward. Essentially, it's a California company, right? CDR Financial is accused of giving Richardson's organization somewhere around $100,000 and in return getting $1.5 million contract from the state. What's been the governor's reaction to this? How has he responded? He's denied the allegations, right?
Well, he has denied them. He said some time ago, last week or the week before, that he had no connection and he expected every officer in the state, offices involved, to be cleared of any wrongdoing. Beyond that, we don't know. He has said nothing beyond the statement he made Sunday that he was withdrawing from the campaign so that any delay in his nomination process would not impede the Obama transition and the Obama administration from going forward.
But, Bill, you know, there is one sort of disturbing element here, and that is that unquestionably Richardson had to know there was some sort of involvement here. I mean, Richardson had to understand that he wasn't squeaky clean. So this bears pretty directly on Bill Richardson's judgment, both in terms of being a Commerce Secretary and in having a relationship with the new president.
Well, that's the word going around, of course, that there's some word that the Obama administration has pushed him out. He's denying that, saying that he made the decision to withdraw voluntarily.
Yeah, because that goes to the timeline. Essentially, this information was already in the hopper when the governor did accept this nomination from the Obama transition team.
It was in the hopper, absolutely.
But it was in the hopper without Bill Richardson's name. I guess the question is, who went to whom at that point? And it's conceivable, number one, that Bill Richardson is guilty, and that's why he's doing it. And I don't want you to say that one way or another. But it's also conceivable that someone in the Obama administration just basically turned and said, you know what, we're done.
Well, and two, you have to question, I believe, the timing of the leak. How do leaks happen from grand juries? That's a very mysterious thing. It's a crime for a grand jury to leak information. The judge is not going to do it. Jurors shouldn't do it. Office members shouldn't do it. How does this happen? You have to kind of wonder, with federal prosecutors who are Republicans having just 2 weeks left in their jobs, why did this happen now?
Here's a question for you. Bill Dupuy, news director of KSFR Santa Fe Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Femi Aoki has just joined us, and she's got headlines.
And the time is 27 minutes past the hour. Muslim countries are pressing for a special session of the United Nations to stop the fighting in Gaza. Malaysia's prime minister says that he hopes the U.S. doesn't stand in the way. On Saturday, the U.S. blocked approval of a Security Council statement calling for an immediate ceasefire. President-elect Barack Obama is ready to start business in Washington today. He arrived yesterday from Chicago, and today he will meet with congressional leaders about a proposed economic stimulus plan. Relief is on the way to those hit by a series of earthquakes in eastern Indonesia. More than 100 buildings were badly damaged in the tremors yesterday. The government is warning people not to return to certain buildings yet, as aftershocks are still a possibility. Two foreign journalists working in Somalia are free after nearly 6 weeks in captivity. They were working on a piracy story when they were kidnapped in November. The National Union of Somali Journalists condemned the abductions, and Australian and Canadian journalists abducted near the Somali capital of Mogadishu in August are still being held hostage. Now, it's the first day of school in Washington for Barack Obama's two daughters, and they'll be accompanied by their mum to Sidwell Friends School this morning. Sasha is attending school in a school campus in suburban Maryland, and her older sister, Malia, is in the middle school building in D.C. And that's a look at some of the stories making news for you this morning.
How many
morning.
Reporters do you think are going to be at that school?
Probably more than the school children at the school.
They set up the daycare for the reporters who are there. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Here's a word for you. Inauguration. It's 2 weeks away for President-elect Barack Obama. We want to know, are you going? Would you like to go? Do you know anyone that is going? Why? Why go? Why would it be important for you to go? And if you are going, who are you going with? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We are trying to put a story to all those numbers of the people who are expected in Washington, D.C. on January 20th.
Among the people who are converging on Washington this week are people who fancy themselves senators. And among the dramas about who will be seated in the Senate, of course, is the Roland Burris story in Illinois, but also the Al Franken, Norm Coleman story in Minnesota. Al Franken leads Republican incumbent Norm Coleman by 225 votes after a lengthy, detailed, and convoluted recount that still faces legal challenges. But it appears that the Franken campaign will declare victory today after the canvassing board certifies the 225-vote margin. Joining us now to speak about this is Tom Scheck, reporter from Minnesota Public Radio. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Hey, John.
And first things first, let's get the important stuff out of the way. I gather there's a new voter in Minnesota. His name's Owen.
Owen, my son. Yeah, the big argument in the press corps for the last couple of months, would Owen be born before the senator was declared victor, you know, the victor in the race, and Owen won by about a week or so.
Owen won by about a week. Well, congratulations, Tom.
Thank you.
And I'm on my best behavior today because this is a serious story about a real Senate seat now that looks like it's within the grasp of Al Franken. Where does it go from here?
Well, today the state canvassing board is likely, unless there are any major hiccups, to declare Franken the victor in the recount. And he'll win by about 225 votes. But that isn't going to be the end of the story. This is going to go to in two different fronts. The first front is the Coleman campaign is likely to file an election contest in court, a lawsuit where they're going to argue that the recount was flawed in several places. Most notably, they say that some votes were double counted in the recount. They also argue that votes that were missing in Minneapolis were counted when they shouldn't have been. When you add all of these factors in, they say Coleman could end up winning. The other factor is what's going to happen in the U.S. Senate, because the Democrats appear that they're suggesting. New York Senator Chuck Schumer the other day said, well, if Al Franken's a winner, we're going to try and seat him, even if there are court challenges going on. And Republicans say, well, no, that's not going to happen. We're going to filibuster this. And they do still have the power to filibuster.
Well, let's talk about the court challenges then. Is there an evidence threshold that the challenge has to meet to throw out the recount or open this all up again? Or is it pretty much just piecemeal, one vote at a time?
Well, they could go through and start pulling in the court. What happens is a three-judge panel is appointed, and they could start pulling in evidence. There could be fact-finding. This could last a couple of months if they choose to, and they could actually order a new recount if they wish. Anyone can file an election contest, whether it's a voter, a party like the Republican or Democrat Party, or the candidate themselves, and they have a week to do it from the day that the winner is declared. So if the canvassing board declares Franken the winner today, Norm Coleman or someone else would have 7 days to file an election contest. Now, if an election contest is filed, the certificate of election that is sent to the Senate won't be sent because it has to be signed by the Secretary of State, which is a Democrat, and the governor, who's a Republican. And the governor is going to be very unlikely to sign that if Norm Coleman wants to continue to fight this battle.
But the Senate can seat him regardless of what the Secretary of State and the governor do, right?
That's correct. Under the powers of the Constitution, they could say, we think Al Franken won this race. We get to determine who sits in our body. And they could go forward, conceivably tomorrow if they wish, when all the other newly elected senators are sworn in, and make a push to declare Al Franken the winner and try and seat him. Typically, sometimes when we've studied this, what they also will do is say, well, let's take this under advisement. Let's send it to the Rules Committee and study from where we should go from here until this court challenge is settled. But it appears right now that the Democrats, the high-powered Democrats in the Senate, are starting to say and suggest Franken should be seated. Hmm.
And is there any jurisdiction beyond the state system in terms of court challenge if it goes all the way to the state Supreme Court in Minnesota and they say it's fine, we don't love it, but let's proceed?
Well, they could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, but as you know, I mean, the 2000 recount was in the Florida Bush v. Gore was the time where the U.S. Supreme Court really got involved, but they don't like to get involved in state races like this, so they typically stay out. So the final recourse is this election contest, which could take a couple of months.
And there would be massive sort of separation of powers issues there and also state rights issues, I would think. So it looks like, at least for a day or so, Al Franken will be the senator from Minnesota, at least on paper, and as you've described all the procedural things that happen between now and then, do you think you'll have an actual senator by the time Owen gets to vote 18 years from now?
That's a very, very good question. We're not sure about that. And actually, right now, Minnesota doesn't have a senator because Norm Coleman's tenure ended on Saturday. So he is now a former senator as well. And that's a big concern among Minnesotans is are there going to be two senators representing the state? Owen is worried about this. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I'm sure Owen is worried about a lot more things than that, Tom. And you're going to find out about every single one of them over the next few months. Tom Scheck with a new baby reporter from Minnesota Public Radio. His new son named Owen and Tom spoke with us about the Senate race in Minnesota where Al Franklin leads Norm Coleman by 225 votes. What other updates do you have, Femi Okay, with the headlines?
Hello there. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. So lawmakers are on their way to Washington to convene the 111th Congress. And that includes Roland Burris, who's the Illinois Senate appointee. Now, he says that his appointment is legal and says he doesn't know what all the confusion is about. Last night, his church in Chicago gave him a rousing send-off. Burris made it clear he intended to be senator.
They couldn't have sent a better person to Washington to represent the 13 million people of the state of Illinois than myself. I've dedicated my life to public service, and you all have caused me to have the opportunity to serve.
Burris was named by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. The governor faces federal charges for previous attempts to sell the Senate seat. It was formerly held by President-elect Barack Obama. Meanwhile, President-elect has tapped Virginia Governor Tim Kaine to be the next chair of the Democratic National Committee. He will work part-time until 2010 when his term as governor is up, and then he'll take on the post full-time. The current DNC chair, Howard Dean, plans to step down later this month. Yesterday was the first round of the NFL playoff action. The Philadelphia Eagles beat the Minnesota Vikings and they take on Super Bowl champs, the New York Giants. The Baltimore Ravens defeated the Miami Dolphins and they face off against the Tennessee Titans. If you're trying to get to an inaugural ball and you just can't afford the $10,000, a couple of hundred, the $25,000 ahead of ticket, there is a new ball that's just been announced by the Presidential Inaugural Committee. It's called the Neighborhood Ball. It will be for residents of D.C. It will be for people who can't afford to go to a ball. The tickets will be free or nearly free. You just have to watch out for the Presidential Inaugural Committee's site to see when those tickets might be available. There will also be linking up with other festivities around the country. There'll be text, there'll be internet.
Are you holding a ball, Femi?
No? Very, very small one in my bedroom. Oh, don't talk about it.
No, thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And perhaps it's fair to say that over the last 25 to 30 years, one narrative, certainly not the narrative, but one narrative of American culture as it relates to technology is the story of the company Apple Computer. Joining us now is Stephen Levy, a journalist for Wired Magazine, author of the book Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh. That, of course, is the Apple computer that changed everything. He joins us from San Francisco. Stephen, thanks for being a part of the program.
My pleasure.
So Macworld begins today, which is a giant sort of exposition that is all about Mac culture and the culture of Apple computers versus everything else going on in the personal computing world. And there's a new chapter in this narrative of where Apple is, and that is that, number one, Steve Jobs is not going to be speaking, he usually does at Macworld, and that Apple has declared a separation from the Macworld exposition, signaling that maybe it doesn't want to participate in this cult of personality around both Jobs and the Apple company. What is the significance of this?
Well, there's no one is really sure, you know,
what this means in terms of a long-term significance. What Apple says is that it wants more control over the way it introduces its products. Generally, it does have that control, but it does have this once-a-year gathering of the Macintosh tribes here in San Francisco, and it's not run by Apple. It's run by a different company, a publishing company, and I don't think they like the idea that every year they have to come up with something at a certain time dictated by someone else that they don't have total control over. So for that reason, they say not only is Steve Jobs not going to give what's called the Steve Note, which is a much anticipated keynote speech where he introduces some mind-blowing new product and everyone's jaw drops and they get very excited, and but instead they'll do that kind of thing. Maybe the cult of personality will continue, but not under the guise of Macworld. Maybe a big event that Apple itself organizes.
Well, Stephen, let's remind people the iPhone was introduced in this way. The flash memory Macintosh laptop was introduced in this way. All of the Macintosh, the titanium MacBooks were introduced this way. So many pieces of technology were introduced this way. How much of this is a function purely of the succession issue within Apple? Steve Jobs is perceived to be not in the best of health. There is no successor at this point. From the perspective of Mac, acolytes, the tribes, it would be difficult to imagine a successor. How much of this is all about Steve Jobs?
Well, that's the question looming over this decision. The question is whether, Steve, as you point out, he had cancer a few years ago. He had surgery. It appears that complications of the surgery have affected to some degree his health. Some people speculate whether it's even more serious than that. And we'll know when and if in a few months or some other period of time he comes back and gives his,
right,
great new product under his own terms.
But we'll have to see.
That's the question.
I mean, a generation ago, Stephen, there were Kremlinologists. Now there's just Stephen Levy trying to determine what is going on under the guise, behind the veil of the Apple computer company.
Believe me, I'm not alone. If you
all right, Stephen, I know you're not. Stephen Levy, journalist for Wired Magazine, reporting on Macworld, which opens today without, as Stephen said, Steve Jobs.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 5th. And Femi, I think you've got a few headlines, don't you?
I absolutely do. 30 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Obama is looking for a new Commerce Secretary. The New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson pulled out as his original pick. Richardson is under investigation for dealings with a campaign contributor. Both Richardson and the donor deny any pay for play took place. Richardson will stay on as governor of New Mexico. Congressional Democrats say that a new stimulus package won't be ready until mid-February. The plan could cost up to $775 billion, and President-elect Obama is meeting with top Democrats on the bill today. India says that it's turned over a detailed report to Pakistan, saying that the Mumbai attackers were Pakistan-based. The November attacks killed 164 people. India has long held that Pakistani elements launched them, and Pakistan requested proof and now says that it's reviewing the report. A British and Spanish journalist who went to Somalia to investigate piracy got a little closer to their story than they expected. Both were kidnapped and kept hostage for almost 6 weeks. Here's journalist Colin Freeman speaking just after his release.
What I can tell you is that, yeah, we were treated well, and that we talked to each other a lot during the time when we were kidnapped, just to keep our spirits up.
And journalist Freeman works for a newspaper called The Sunday Telegraph in the UK. He's already been blogging about his experience. He says he can't wait to get back to his family, his girlfriend, and even better, a strong pint of lager. That's a look at some of the news making the headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So we're looking for your help out there. We want to hear stories about people traveling to actually witness the inauguration in Washington, D.C. on January 20th. Are you going? How are you getting there? And what lengths are you taking to get there?
My name is Melissa Rosen from Warwick, New York. Yes, I am going to the inauguration with my 15-year-old daughter and my 24-year-old cousin. We are going. We will be there somewhere way far back, probably sitting in Mr. Lincoln's lap.
I kind of wish people would actually discuss the fact that there's going to be, like, horrible wheelchair access and disability access. I am planning on going because my cousin is in the Army Band. He's going to be in the first line of the parade as a trombonist.
Trombonist of the world unite. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org with your inauguration pilgrimage story.
Today, rockets continue to be fired from Gaza into Israel by militants. Those attacks are happening as Israel's army is marching deep into Palestinian territory. Gazan health officials say the death toll there is up to 537 since Israel began its military campaign against Hamas, with civilian casualties on the rise. Only a few reporters are operating inside Gaza. We spoke earlier to two of them covering the story for our partners there. Tigreed El-Khodari is reporting for the New York Times, and she's in Gaza City. Rushdi Abu Alouf works for the BBC, and he was also in Gaza. Rushdi, when I asked him what he had seen today and what the conditions were like in Gaza.
Yes, so far since the midnight, we have seen more than 30 Israeli airstrikes targeting mainly installations for Hamas, but also houses, and a mosque was hit in the north. In one of the airstrikes, a missile was hit a house that belonged to Hamas military wing commander. He survived that, but his brother, along with his five of extended family members, were killed in a place called Shatte, a refugee camp in the west of Gaza Strip.
And you've been to a local hospital. Which one, and what did you see there?
Yeah, I have been to Shifa Hospital, which is the main hospital in Gaza. We have seen doctors are struggling to cope with the situation. They are trying to treat as much people as they could with the little they have from equipment and basic supplies. All the crossings between Gaza and Israel and between Gaza and Egypt are closed, and the doctors are saying that they are running out of medicine. They are running out even of essential medicine, and they are running out of blood as well. So that's why they were calling the people of Gaza to go to the nearest hospital and donate in their blood to be able to help the
injured. Mm-hmm. And Tigreed, you're actually at that hospital right now, right?
Yeah, it's awful. It's gruesome. I just came out from the emergency room. Many children are coming. Shrapnel are spread all over their bodies. Some can make it and live, but others die on the spot. Earlier, 11 members of one family died. Among them, many children. I can count. Like, one is 4 years old. Another is 5 months old. Another is 3 years old. Another is four. Another is four. And also from the same family, 26 are injured, among them 10 women and 6 children. What we are noticing here, and I just spoke to the Red Cross. Red Cross cannot go to the locations. People are calling them, come and rescue us. They are asking them to come and rescue them, and they can't. Ambulance drivers cannot get in because they are afraid. Also, the Red Cross, they are trying to coordinate with the Israelis, but no luck.
Agreed. Let me ask you this. If there's so much that's difficult in terms of getting aid in and out or getting doctors and equipment into hospitals, how come the rockets are still firing out into Israel from Gaza? Do you have any report on that?
This is the thing. You know, the fighters are managing to fire rockets from Gaza towards Israel. And it seems they are firing from residential areas. And that's why when Israel retaliates, they don't, you know, they just fire anywhere, no matter what. And it seems the message to Hamas that we cannot get you, we cannot kill you, but we can kill the people. That's why many civilians are killed. So they are trying to pressure Hamas death, by the killing of civilians, and this is what I'm getting. I've been in the hospital since yesterday.
No, understood, Tagri. Rushdie, let me just bring you in on one point here. What is the sense that Hamas is being taught a lesson, particularly now that Israeli soldiers are on the ground in Gaza? Tagri, you begin, and then Rushdie, go ahead.
Yeah, what's happening, you can hear people who lost their loved ones cursing Hamas for the first time. So much pain, and they are blaming Hamas, some of them. But others who lost also loved ones, this is the thing. It seems that the policy may backfire. Others are blaming Israel and wish to revenge, you know, the Israelis, because they think Israel is the reason for all of that. So you never know what will be the result of the Israeli policy.
Great point,
Tagri. Civilians.
Rushdie, what's your response to that?
I think Hamas is believe that they are. This is the last battle, and they have to fight until the end. One of the big leaders of Hamas, Dr. Mahmoud Zahar, was appeared for the first time today, and he promised the people of Gaza that Hamas will claim victory very soon. Today we are in the 10th day of the offensive, and rockets are still being fired into Israel. So Hamas is still capable to fire rockets toward Israel in spite of all the Israeli action in Gaza, ground troops, airstrikes, day and night. But they are still surviving, and they are still managing to fire rockets.
And Rushdie, yesterday it was 45 missiles. Today, at least, it's been reported at least 20. At what point, though, does Hamas risk the wrath of Palestinians?
Of course, the shelling, the airstrikes are damaging or lifting a great damage in the Hamas infrastructure, not only in their infrastructure, but in their movement. They are not able to move. Israeli are monitoring Gaza day and night by their balloons and by their drones over Gaza. Air Force are carrying out attacks everywhere. So they are facing difficulties to fire rockets, especially after Gaza City has been isolated by tanks. We are talking about 500,000 people are living in this city, surrounded by tanks from everywhere. So Israel is trying to cut Gaza into three parts to stop rockets being smuggled from the south of Gaza Strip into Gaza City and to make it harder for Hamas to continue fire rockets. That was we have seen in the beginning of the offensive, 60 rockets in a day, and today we have seen only 5.
Thank you. That was the BBC's Rushdie Abu-Alouf and also Tagri El-Khodri from The New York Times. Thanks to both of them for joining us from Gaza City.
Gripping eyewitness voices from an area where many reporters cannot work. We're looking for your help. We want to hear stories about people traveling to the inauguration in Washington, D.C. How are you getting there? And maybe you don't want to go.
I am not going to the inauguration, and you couldn't pay me to go. I have no interest in going. It'll be televised and in the newspapers, and I saw a bumper sticker again saying Obama 08, and I'm just hoping that Obama 09 will be a good president.
Well, and one less person there in Washington with the 5 million. Email us your story at mytake@thetakeaway.org or leave us a message at 877-8-MYTAKE. And your takeaway this morning comes from...
This could last a couple of months if they choose to, and they could actually order a new recount if they wish.
It's Tom Scheck, reporter from Minnesota Public Radio, talking about the still legally hamstrung standoff between Al Franken and Norm Coleman, although Franken is ahead by 200 votes. We're always on, and if you missed anything, like all the details of how they're going to resolve things in Minnesota, go to our our podcast to go at iTunes, or you can subscribe to it at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.